So I am very happy to be here. Happy to have a chance to join your community, to have some time to practice together. I want to start with a question. The question is, where does the deepest inspiration come from? As we were going through the chants, on the one that I could keep up with, which was the English version of the Heart Sutra, when it got to the part about Sariputra, it triggered a story that I had heard. I think it more of a legend than a story. It's epic in proportion. The story as it was told to me, because we really don't know for sure what happened unless we were there. So as it's been told to me, the monk Sariputra and his compadre Moggallana were practicing meditation together ardently. And they were advancing, they felt, quite well. The insights were coming, the understanding into the nature of reality was unfolding. They got to a point where in their meditation they both felt together somewhat dissatisfied with what they had been given. They reached a point of, you could say, threshold. They didn't know how to proceed further. And they were looking for a teacher, and they didn't know where to look. And what I'd like to suggest is that if your whole existence, if your whole life in this world is solely pointed at realization, solely pointed at emancipation, that probably would mean that you are very devoted and passionate to realization. It probably wouldn't mean that every single distraction is gone. Because here they were facing a distraction, which is our practice cannot deepen any further, and we realize this together. So I'm sure they were conversing about it. I'm not sure. I imagine they were conversing about it, what to do. And it so happened that they crossed paths with a monk. And this monk was walking. And as it was told to me, Sariputra noticed the monk. And this monk was aglow. And it was very evident. And it was very compelling. And he pointed out this monk to Moggallana. And so they felt, let's approach him and ask him, who is your teacher? So they did. And the monk said, my teacher is Gautama, the Buddha. Sariputra said, it looks to me, sir, that you are fully free, you're a fully realized being. Is that true? And the monk said, that's true. Can you imagine that on 4th Street, 6th Street, Gainesville, Florida, walk up to a being and say, it appears to me that you're fully realized, and that being says, yes, I am. Anyways, he said, well, do you think that he would teach us if we went to him? He said, yes, he's in this village some distance away. Just go. He will teach you. So they hurried off. You can imagine the power of the inspiration, yes? Here's a monk that said, yes, I'm fully realized, and here's my teacher, and he'll teach you. So they hustled off to find the Buddha. And when they found him, they received the teachings in 1 week, as the legend goes. They both realized in full emancipation. And here's the part of the story that I want to emphasize most. After this happened for them, they became the right and left-hand men of the historical Buddha. They were like the lieutenants on either side in the army of peace. And as the story was told to me, every night before he went to bed, Sariputra said to whoever was around, "Does anyone know where Bhante Asuji is tonight?" Bhante Asuji was the name of the monk who told them about the Buddha. And people would say, "Yes, he was in this town, or he was here, or he was there." And every night until his passing, dropping the body, as it's sometimes said, Moggallana would bow down in the direction that he was told Bhante Asuji was in. That way, that way, that way. He would bow down in that direction, and then when he would go to sleep, he would lie down and place his head in that direction. The feeling might have been one of immeasurable gratitude. The feeling might have been one, if there was a feeling, there might have been one of immeasurable love. We're in a situation where the beauty of the Dharma is being expressed in so many different ways on planet Earth. The beauty of the Dharma might be the place where some of you receive your deepest inspiration. We're in a situation where if we are not confused too much by the power of suffering, of potential unhappiness, of potential ignorance, then something comes up through in the form of seeking. When human beings encounter unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, suffering, or as it's called in the Pali language, dukkha, sometimes they simply turn away, defend against, withdraw, and as someone recently said, try to party their way through. Have a good time until the last breath. That's a human being who's feeding the sense of separation even stronger through avoidance and denial. But once the inspiration of the Dharma flowers, it's so powerful that it wraps into it, for some human beings, every single part of their life. And they begin to seek. Because perhaps they've heard and believe something along the lines of "seek and ye shall find. Ask and you will be given. Give and you shall receive." In some version. The Dharma, as it came to me personally, came initially through the power of concentration. I was told years later that the Dharma in the East, in many cases, was always given initially through the teachings on the heart. That forgiveness and giving without expecting anything in return, generosity was emphasized first, then concentration, then insight. It took a while to see that through concentration, insights did emerge. And through insights, the heart began to be initially softened, relaxed, opened, and something along the lines of giving without expecting anything in return began to make some sense. What is your deepest inspiration? What do you get up for in the morning? What do you go to bed with at night? If these words work at all, they are pointing at something that's indescribable. The word is never the thing. And yet, the word used skillfully and well points. So I'm going to share some words that will point, I hope. Can we see into what the word is pointing to? And if there's a seeing into what the word is pointing to, sometimes there's a seeing through. These two words, seeing through, are sometimes considered to be analogous to the process of insight, the nature of awakening. So if the human is not just consciously and unconsciously involved in being defended against reality, then the human being opens into the reality. What is the reality? Very classic, powerful teaching, the five skandhas or five aggregates: body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness. That's the body-mind process. That's what's sitting here, in a sense. Human beings, out of ignorance, misunderstanding, doesn't mean they're stupid. It means they're ignoring the truth, the way things really are. Identify, to varying degrees, with one or more of these skandhas. Notice how powerful the tendency to identify with feeling. Not just that, but split it. The pleasant is better than the unpleasant. That a quiet mind, a still mind, a slow-moving thought is somehow better than a fast, jumbled, confused thought. That you are the consciousness that's observing these other skandhas. In the immediacy of childlike wonder, it can be noticed that you don't know who you are. What I took from Sen Sanin when I was with him, what he gave me, was "don't know mind." He kept saying it, "don't know, don't know," with such juicy energy, it was very compelling. Yes, I don't know who I am. Yes, I don't know where I come from. Yes, I don't know where I'm going. We think we're sitting on the top of the earth. The earth is underneath us. This is perception. Who says we're not on the left or the right? This side or that side or the bottom. Perception masquerades through ignorance as reality. When perception shifts, so-called reality shifts. For some people, the question, "who are you? What are you?" is the most compelling, inspirational set of words. we're in an interesting situation. Our experience is an abstraction. Our experience is an appearance. If we take a simple aspect of physics and biochemistry and put them together, the universe is made up of relatively organized chaos. Chaos is formless matter in infinite space. So what does that mean? It means our experience is organized chaos. That's what our nervous system does, is it organizes chaos to the best of its ability. Sometimes in meditation or just in life circumstances, apparent chaos takes over. There can be confusion, fear, disorientation, and a loss of centeredness. For many human beings, this is something to be avoided. In awakening to what you really are, a certain amount of confusion and chaos must be gone through. A relaxation into not understanding, not being able to cognize what's happening. And yet somehow through that, I'll use the word, a presence shines. That presence is shining through the eyes of these bodies. Who are you? The answer to the question, who are you, in depth, dissolves the question, dissolves the one who needs an answer. Awakening is a non-attainment. It's a falling away of the idea and fixation upon who you think you are, or what you think you are, or what you feel you are, or what you perceive you are. It's like falling asleep, but there's no unconsciousness. It seems like every human being wants happiness and peace, wants fulfillment, looks for that fulfillment, that peace, that happiness, through different actions. The hidden secret is that fulfillment doesn't come about through an action or an activity, because fulfillment isn't an act or an action. So what is it? What is fulfillment? Again, the historical Buddha reportedly said, actions without an actor, doings without a doer. It's the heart of the Bhagavad Gita. Our predicament, until it isn't, is that if our experience is abstracted chaos, and we accomplish a certain amount, you could say, of thinning or dissipation of the forms of trouble that we might encounter, we find it impossible, it seems, to abstract suffering. Because there can be a belief or view, perception, that I am suffering. Suffering is happening to me. We can't find the me or the I that suffering is happening to, but we claim it nonetheless. notice the I or me who appears to own or possess anything, sticking with suffering for the moment, can't be found. That's part of the answer to the question or the inquiry. Who are you? Ignorance, or simply the tendency, the habit of not seeing things the way they really are, generates sense, attachment. It generates attachment to practices and precepts. It generates attachment to views and beliefs. But the real central kingpin, queenpin, is that it generates attachment to a sense of I or me, to whom beliefs, views, practices, precepts, and sense experiences happen. I like to keep it kind of simple. When I can. Most human beings have no problem with deep sleep. They love it. They love it so much, it's called, in some cases, the poor man, poor woman's nirvana. It's the best that you can get until you wake up in it. There is no past. There is no future. There is no problem. There is no money, anxiety, fear, confusion. There is no body. There is no perception. It's kind of like the Heart Sutra. The poor man, poor woman's nirvana. Does that mean I must get richer in order to have it for real? We're in a funny situation. And the Sufis put it so well when they said, what we speak of cannot be found by seeking, but only seekers find it. What we speak of cannot be found through seeking, but only seekers find it. What do they find? Some words are given. The pearl beyond price. Once it's clear that even cognition, feeling, perception of dualistic dharma is priceless, then something of the taste of the pearl beyond price has begun. In the Kina Upanishad, there's a particular set of words. They go like this. Not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eye can see. Know this, and this alone to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that which the ears hear, but that whereby the ears can hear. Know this, and this alone to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that which is sensed, but that whereby sensing happens. Know this, and this alone to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that which the mind thinks, but that whereby thinking can happen. Know this and this alone to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. The Dharma, the truth of the way things really are, is beyond comprehension in essence. It's beyond. That means before as well. Any tradition. Awakening is a nothingness at first that the mind can't make sense of. Like falling asleep, only not going unconscious. There is a trance occurring called the identification with form or with emptiness. There's a trance occurring called identification. Daily, for many human beings, this trance is pierced. It falls away. And I don't mean through falling asleep. And yet what happens when that trance falls away is often not recognized. It's too subtle. And thus it's ignored. I was walking on a street in Ireland one day. And I came to the intersection. And the light indicated, don't cross. So I stood, turned and looked to my left, and there was a mother with three children. The children appeared to be perhaps 12, maybe 7 or 6, and perhaps 2 or 3. I had just come out of a very beautiful experience being with people, inquiring and meditating and being silent. So there was a bit of sensitization that had took place. You never really know why things happen. They just happen. Anyways, I looked at the woman and I saw the furrowed brow and the tightened shoulders and the hands around the handles of the carriage. And the eyes, without a thought, moved to the oldest child. And the apparent burden of conditioned existence seemed lighter. And then the eyes went to the next child down, the 6 or 7 year old. And the light of being was shining more clearly. And then the eyes landed on the 2 or 3 year old. And the 2 or 3 year old's eyes came right back. And there was a resting into the peace of being. Why are we called human beings instead of human becomings or human doings? Why are so many teachers these days talking about enlightenment as the realization of being? So in a way, perhaps, our original nature, our Buddha nature, because, you know, we're all Buddhas with amnesia, attempting to remember ourselves. George Gurdjieff probably caught the wave of passion and inspiration, came out of Eastern Europe and found the Sufi dervishes in the mountains around where Osama bin Laden is supposedly hanging out now. And the essence of Gurdjieff's teachings, as I have received them, seems to be about self-remembering. How about just remembering? Awakening is the realization that you always and already are what you are. And everything else and everyone else is that also. Zen Master Dogen said it well, I think, when he said, enlightenment is intimacy with all things. He went on to say also, the person is no one in particular, but rather like the limitless deep blue sky is everyone and everything. These words point to something that can only be realized when the one who's looking falls away. There is no witness, and yet there is witnessing. We can prove it right now. Nobody can find the witness. Nobody can find the self that remembers. And yet the fragrance, the color, the tone of remembering can come through any moment. I don't know how long I'm supposed to carry on.
Until you run out of steam.
Oh, yeah?
I'm getting warmed up. I find talking like this to be a love affair that I sometimes hate. Because to get up here and do this, I have to kind of die. And if you don't die, like Coleman Barks used to say while reading Rumi, if I don't die while reading Rumi, then it's not Rumi. I imagine I have some more to say, but I'd like to see what you have to say. That was a rather short talk, half hour, a little less perhaps. Covered some points, pointed to some things. Anything that was stirred, question, comment, observation?
Like an observation, most of the things you said I've at least touched on in my own practice and gone through, and I always find it really interesting to see how someone else puts it all together in a way that they would like to explain and help others see it. And it's always a very unique way that everybody has their own flavor of how they want to say things. And I like the way the way that you crafted that, you know, and just some of the things you said. Especially towards the end, when you kind of brought it all back together and said that we are everything. I mean, that was something that I came to on my own just one day, and I noticed that a bunch of other folks had done the same thing. Is that, you know, this world is, there's no separation. And Casey talked about this a little while back in one of his talks. I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe. I'm not sure. About this whole world, we're all interconnected. It's all, even my sitting here and seeing all of you is just me, or whatever I am, perceiving what all this is, and it's just everything's just back and forth and connected, and all this is one big reality. So I like how you put that together. That's really nice.
Yeah. So then, like, the noble truths, four noble truths, the suffering as a cause, the cessation or release from that suffering. And then there's a way to live. Yeah? There's a way to live. The way to live makes total, practical, rational, scientific, intuitive, emotional, kinesthetic sense. Okay. So in the Eightfold Path, the last step, so to speak, is right view. In Pali, it's called Samma. Samma means right. Ditti means view. Right view. The mind gets a hold of the Four Noble Truths. If it's not busy trying to avoid reality, at times the suffering is perceived everywhere. Even the perception of impermanence at first brings such relief. Everything is changing. Wow, everything is changing. As it deepens, as that insight into impermanence deepens, it actually becomes agonizing to feel this impermanence. Nothing lasts. Nothing lasts. Nothing lasts. And so the mind gets a hold of the teachings, doesn't it? The mind gets a hold of the Eightfold Path. The right effort, the right concentration, right speech, and it makes complete sense. And yet the teachings, in one sense, metaphorically, are a thorn that take out the thorn. Everyone's used the needle to take out a splinter. If one digs too deep with the needle, one experiences additional pain in attempting to take out the splinter. The mind gets a hold of the teachings, attaches to the practice or the precept of it. And then there sitting, crown jewel, samaditti, right view. Nothing need be added. Nothing need be taken away. Everything is as it is, always, already. Nothing need be removed or changed. Indescribable, those words point to a nothingness that's everything. Anything else anyone would like to explore?
I have a question for you, Paul.
Yeah.
You had mentioned the idea of how our natural tendency is to turn away from suffering and pain and things like that, and how liberation occurs when we can investigate those things and go through. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about a practical application of that, like maybe during a sitting meditation session, maybe with various thoughts and feelings that are arising, maybe a practical application of how we face these things.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. As far as I can see, liberation doesn't occur for anyone, to anyone. Awakening is the glimpse of non-separation. I like to describe it as the me dissolves and there's just beingness. And then the me can appear again just as quickly as it dissolved. And there's a dance between me and being. Another way to put it is everything is being itself. Everything is being itself as it is. And you are that. The idea that someone will awaken through practice is an idea. The awakening is the falling away of the idea that you will awaken. It's a taste. So, with sitting practice, let's say, so many different styles and methods, they're almost all for the mind to work on itself. Until they aren't. So something as simple as breathing. Why is it that in the Pali Canon, the two sutras on meditation, one had to do with mindfulness, Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations of mindfulness, how to pay attention in all these ways, and the other was on the breathing. And the whole sutra was on emancipation through breath. And it's just laid out. The conundrum, you might say, or the challenge, or the confusion that we at times face in practice is that we're trying to go somewhere. We're trying to untie something. We're trying to change an experience. We're trying to get back to something that was better, or something that felt more peaceful, or something that felt more comfortable, or something that felt more awake. All of this is like chasing a carrot. I've noticed that my dog never manifests any mood disorder that I can see. She awakens every morning, and regardless, she's pretty old now, she's got some arthritis, they say, but she awakens, and every morning she's plop, bang, right there, happy, responsive. Doesn't complain. I've noticed that blades of grass will sometimes shoot up right through the crack in the concrete, the softest blade of grass through a hard surface, and found that light pop through. The beauty of sitting meditation, as I have realized it, is that it's in a way, in essence, about realizing everything is as it is. Nothing's better or worse. It's samaditti, it's right view. Nothing needs to change. When Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," he perhaps contributed to a global event which we're still in the pathos of. Before he uttered that, historically, there was the proclamation, "I am that I am." That's beingness, being itself. It's childlike wonder informed in a way that's transcendentally wise. See, the child can be transcendentally wise and not know it. It's from friends of mine with the Karmapa in New York. I had dinner with them the other night. And I said, "What did the Karmapa talk about?" A 22-year-old glowing being, Karmapa. Of course, there's a debate about who the real one is. They got one in Europe, and they think he's the one, and the one out of India. The other people say he's the mind's got to do it, right? Till it doesn't. Anyways, what did Karmapa talk about? Talked about cutting through confusion. Cutting through confusion was the topic. Sounds good to me. So what's driving sometimes the very meditative practice that one might feel very into, if not realized, is fear and confusion. What do I mean? The attempt to remove fear and confusion, which would be deeper rooted into the attempt to remove suffering. Imagine this. All you are is suffering. Just completely 100% suffering. Would you want to be removed? Everything wants to be itself. It's, you could say, human nature. And yet everything keeps changing, doesn't it? What I'm saying is everything keeps changing, and in awakening, nothing needs to change. So we can then look at teachings that have a progression of insight culminating. And when I was first taught Vipassana meditation, it was taught very, very charismatically, very compelling, very full of loving kindness. But it was dualistic in that it kept referring to, if I was to do this, 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 I will get that. It plugged right into my Judeo-Christian conditioning, which told me that heaven existed someplace else. Because nobody could decode what Christ apparently said when he said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed." People had a shot at it, but they were all running around in the thought. Nothing need be different. Nothing need be added. Nothing need be taken away. As that pops through in the meditation, so to speak, which I like to consider life itself. Sitting practice is just something that happens sometimes. Meditation is life living itself. Life living itself is meditation. There is no meditator. Notice that. There's an idea that you could be meditating, there's no meditator that you can find. Let's pause right there. In fact, let's full stop right there. Where are we going? Some people grab hold of this idea and they go, oh, okay, I don't need to do nothing. I'll just drink beer and watch TV. Heedless. As the fire of awakening is burning, heedlessness is burned away. I use the word interest, curiosity, and then wonder to describe the energy. I'm not too much on practicals in terms of like how do you untie this knot in your shoulder or, you know, the mind states that come. What if they were all just the most welcomed guests? What if they were met unconditionally? It's a possibility. Is it getting where you wanted to go, Matthew?
Sorry, I wasn't trying to lead you.
No, it's okay.
But yes.
Good.
Thank you.
I used to have a very big confusion between sincerity and seriousness. I had no ability to distinguish that. You might say I was quite anally retentive in the name of trying to transcend. There's a beautiful poetic verse comes from the Diamond Sutra. Some of you may know the verse. A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, a dream. So all conditioned existence is seen. We are that star at dawn. We are that bubble in the stream. That flash of lightning, that flickering lamp, that phantom, that dream. We are that and not that simultaneously. I had the good fortune to spend a little time with a Vietnamese monk. He was a kind of a hybrid. You couldn't quite pin his tradition. I actually like that myself. Being a rebel with a cause, I hope. I always liked Bob Dylan's definition of the outlaw. In order to live outside the law, you have to be honest. So the monk gets up and he gives this talk. And it was pretty cool. And then he blew my concept of monkdom and monkhood. And he pulled out his business cards. And he went... He said, call me if you want to. Then he really got my attention. He said, do you love what is impermanent or what is permanent? Now that was a dualistic teaching, yeah? Do you love this or that? At that moment, I wanted to say, I love what is permanent, but I know it not. Therefore, I love the flow of impermanence. I love the field of relativity. Why did the historical Buddha, as the legend has it, not just disappear into the Himalayas after the full emancipation under the Bodhi tree? Why did he sit, apparently, as the legend has said to us, under that Bodhi tree for somewhere around 2 weeks in full, you might say, adoration for the tree? Why does the legend have it that an angel or a deva came to him as he was trying to, you might say, figure out what to do after emancipation, and said, teach the Dharma for those with little dust in their eyes? And so the Four Noble Truths, the wheel of Dharma, appeared out of the wheel of samsara. The wheel of samsara. Samsara means perpetual wandering. Lost in states of mind, perceptions, feelings, body consciousness, and that which seems to be the consciousness that's watching this. What happens to that consciousness in deep sleep? Who are you in deep sleep? If you go to the scriptures, a certain section of the scriptures says there is an object. Object means thing. Object occurring in deep sleep. It is the object of peace itself. Interesting. I don't know about you, but when I started to hear teachings about the deathless, about the unconditioned, it grabbed hold in a way that nothing else had ever grabbed. It grabbed hold in a way that loosened everything, slowly but surely. So there became then a differentiation between seriousness and sincerity. Anyone else have a question or a comment? Experience you'd like to share?
So when we get enlightenment, what do we do with it?
Well, from what it seems right now, we don't get it. It gets us.
Then what we do with it?
Whatever happens. I mean, I met a man recently. He's a really simple guy, and he had a very deep, you could say, passion or inspiration to know. And he had the, you know, he's like about 80 years old now, maybe 70, upper 70s, and he was, again, like myself, you know, conditioned into the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he got a hold of, you know, the word repentance. And the word repentance, as he had been taught in his traditional teachings, meant to confess your sins and never sin again. And he said, well, he realized that was impossible for somebody as horny and interested in, you know, alcohol and things as he was. So that was not going to work. So he could say, by luck, found this passage that supposedly was the original definition, meaning for the word repentance, and was to turn and look afresh. Now this for him was a huge poof. Well, then he was walking in a park in London, post-World War II. And I can do that here, right? Unconditional love. No I. Staggered. Didn't say anything about it for years. He was a used car salesman, Casey. Used car salesman. And I met him and he'd begun to share with relatively small groups of people. Enlightenment was manifesting as a funny old man, enjoying himself, sharing, love, silence, stories, senses, it just happens. Whatever's going to happen just happens.
Okay, I can't believe we got about 15, 20 people in this room that haven't got a question. Now we're either intimidated, or our minds have gone blank, or our knees hurt.
I can keep talking if you want, but I don't want to go all the way here. We can just go like this.
Go. You mentioned earlier something that sort of really struck me is the order of compassion and concentration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that you thought you had them reversed.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I would think they sort of have to be a little mixed up going on at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, everything's touching everything else, okay? Right, that's physics right now, clearly. Right, but that's obviously the insight of the mystic too. I wonder why Albert Einstein's hair stood on end so often in his pictures. Right, he's getting like these hits of truth. Anyways, what caught my attention, because my mind was crazy, out of control, just sat down and it was just a mess. And there was a lot of reaction to it. So when a teacher taught me how to concentrate my mind, and I could concentrate, and all that would go away, it was amazing. I felt so much better. Now, hidden inside that gift of concentration, hidden inside the gift of the Dharma, the truth of the way things are, the teachings of liberation, there's the love that makes the world go round. It's generosity. It took me a while to see that. The gifts were priceless. And that they infuse themselves into every aspect of life. Sometimes slowly but surely. No outside. You see, there's a perception right now, perhaps. There's an inside. And then there's an outside. That's just perception. As soon as perception, the aggregate of perception, is seen clearly, it may still be a sense that consciousness is seeing perception clearly. And that you are that consciousness. I simply cut to the chase. Prove it. Prove that you are that consciousness. It's just a word. So the possibility then arises to see that everything is occurring via the power of generosity. Why is it said samsara is nirvana? Perpetual wandering is liberation. That's confusing to the mind, isn't it? Just as awakening, as it appears to be a nothingness, is confusing to the mind that's trying to understand and go someplace. So what's happening for you as I share this with you? Anything particular?
It didn't explain, I don't think, that relationship.
Right.
But I think it's sort of brought it beyond that,
mm-hmm.
sort of underneath, mm-hmm. before the words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was good.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the Casey pushes you. I like it. I like that push. Sometimes. Because we're prone to our habits, right? So, you know the term ahimsa? In Sanskrit it means nonviolence. You know, it was the energy of nonviolence that Gandhi used to free Indian people from the British colonial, patriarchal, egotistical mindset. Martin Luther King borrowed that, didn't he? Brought it into America and the civil rights movement. Ahimsa, nonviolence. What does that really mean? What does nonviolence really, really mean? I'm suggesting that generosity, giving without expecting anything in return. Because we've all had moments where there's a giving without any premeditation. It just flows. There might be a question after, like, oh, okay, was that right? Or da-da-da-da. Was that enough? Or da-da-da-da. The mind comes back in. Gandhi said it so well, I feel. With regard to understanding ahimsa, he said, do not confuse the habitual with the natural. So sometimes in our practice we end up looking at a fair amount of habits of mind and behavior. Meanwhile, lurking, tucked inside even the habit, is the natural unfolding itself. The original natural nature of what we are. We're coming home, in a way. I like to say generosity makes the world go round, not money. But when I come home from a Dharma retreat and some donations have been given, my teenage son is quick on the math. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Anything at all?
I'll throw one last thing out if I can.
Please.
I've been practicing for 10, 11 years. For most of the time it was on my own, just book reading and stuff like that. And as I was sitting here, something just went. I was like, oh, I don't know what that is. So I'm going to throw this out the case. You maybe need to respond with yourself. But for myself, obviously I came to the practice like I would any other thing, something to get, something to gain, something to get a hold of, something to grab and make my life better. And I was out there going for it. I was really working. I was sitting here at some point in mind. I'm going to get it. I'm going to find it and everything. And the way that I was going about it, I saw all these teachings and they were really pointing me in that direction, but I was still running with it anyway. And then there was this little bit of enlightenment. I saw it just once. And the way I can equate it, as I was sitting here, and I was like, it's like I had walked through a door and I'm looking to find out where enlightenment was. And then just for some strange reason, I went backwards through the door and found out that's where it was.
Yeah.
The whole time I'd been doing this.
Yeah.
Looking for it,
yeah.
When I just needed to take a step backwards. And,
yeah.
And I don't know how to comment on this, but I think there's a difference in once you've seen enlightenment for the first time, then to really understand what that is, than it is before you've ever seen it and trying to find it. I think the teachings, there's like a difference there.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. For me, I just see it was like night and day. One day, things were different.
That's like a recognition. Or I also use the word an inversion. Like you were describing this, and then poof. Yeah. It's a flash.
It was just different. I mean, it was as clear as night and day. It was just like...
Yeah.
Oh.
Right.
That's what happened, you know? And for me, there's a difference in how I was able to move forward. But most of the teaching is about like, oh, this is what all that stuff's been saying all this time. I know, I understand it all. I mean, it took a long time. It's like I kept going back over everything I'd been for 5, 6 years. And I'm like, oh, that's what they were trying to say.
Yeah.
And it was real, but there's some difference to get me to, I don't know, there's something, there was a different way. Something different happened. And I think a lot of the folks that have seen it for a second, it's different for everyone. How you end up noticing that you're the one that went through the door.
Yeah.
It was always right there. That's what you need to go back. Where you're going in the wrong direction.
Right. Right. That's the real being that goes through that door. The personality comes along for the ride, but the real being goes through that door. It's like your fingerprint, you know. It's not just true that everybody's fingerprint is different. That's why the cops, when they get your mugshot, they also get your fingerprint, right? It's unique. Just like every grain of sand on every beach on planet Earth. Every single grain of sand is different. Different. Unique. In that uniqueness, right? In that absolute uniqueness, this has never happened before, none of this. Absolutely brilliant, fresh, new. That's an awakening. What you're describing is, in many traditions, is called the glimpse or seeing through. Different words are used. And then what I like to say then is often it's impossible to not have been fundamentally shifted. It's an energetic, intuitive shift. Liberation, right, is different. Awakening, that glimpse, is like, before that you were like a chicken inside an egg, and the eggshell was ignorance. The ignorance pops, and there's a perceptual shift. This gentleman that I mentioned, the guy that had the experience walking in the park, and then the used car salesman, and I started talking. He helped me stop seeking. I don't know how.
Yeah, it's different.
Right? Yeah.
I try to tell people, but I can't describe it. I mean, I've worked really hard to try to convey, because I'm like, oh yeah, this is awesome. Like, share this with someone.
Yeah.
And I tell them, the best way I come up with it is, look at everything you're doing, just look at it, and it's not to get rid of everything, you know, it's gonna go away, it's on its own. And that's right, and I shuffle through my words, and I'm always trying to just like, I don't know. It's hard to convey people. It's kind of like whatever you're doing, that's the problem, probably.
Might be, yeah. Might
so
be.
Like trying to explain love.
I've thought about that before.
I'd rather just feel it. So, I mean, it can get very exciting, too, you know, like some people, they just get very still and very quiet, you know, and very simple. And other people, they get very excited, you know, and there's a desire to express and share, you know, and it manifests in so many different ways. But again, I like to keep it quite simple, you know, it's just like flowers are opening, the sun is rising, clouds are moving, birds are singing. We're sitting here. The fans are turning. This is it. This is it.
There is a gift.
Yeah.
That's one of the ways I describe to people. I go, what are you doing when you're meditating? I go, tell me what you're doing right now. Tell me what you're doing. And then they start telling me things. Like, you're telling me what you're doing. That's all you're doing right now. And I'm like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, I can't really explain anything more simply than that. And then they look at me like I'm crazy and go about their business. I'm like, well, maybe they'll figure it out. And that's all I can do.
Yeah. Please.
Thank you for sharing, and the remembrance you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like when you're speaking, it's like I can feel it from your heart.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you play this musical instrument with your words, and you're just bringing everyone to the moment and the presence with your ability to tell stories, and it's really wonderful. And I'm wondering, when we're remembering in this moment here, and as you're sharing, how to bring that spaciousness and that aliveness, that vibrance, in difficult situations, or when we are asleep, or when we are in fear, when we are in confusion. And so often that peaceful feel, that the sensation that's here when we're present and alive is, and you greet it all, you say, greet all these moments, like the Rumi poem, whatever. How do we do that?
Okay. So we don't do that. You see, it's the opposite of what you're trying to do there. We don't do that. Okay. The mind makes the abyss. The heart crosses it. As the heart, you spoke about the heart, yeah? As the heart, mind, in the certain Chinese dialect, it's the sin-sin. They make no separation between the heart and the mind. Heart-mind, oneness, sin-sin. Then there's a falling away of the tendency to separate spaciousness, peace, tranquility from any state like fear. The nature of this body, just observe it, is that it contracts, it expands over and over. That's its nature. You bought the ticket. You're in the movie. Ride it. Same with the breathing. It expands, it contracts. The mind states expand, it's contract. What falls away initially is the tendency to react to these things that are unpleasant or difficult, and thereby separate those things from other things that are accepted and received well. Okay? That tends to happen for people. And then, as the opening deepens, the identification with the state as mine, the identification with the state as me, as that falls away, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that fear is arising or anger is arising or difficult situations are arising. And the beauty then is that there's a responsiveness that can come through. You see, what you're talking about is how do we bring through some of what the practice has given in its quieter moments, let's say. How do we bring that into difficult situations? And in one sense, it's like a natural progression where as there's an opening and familiarity with non-identification, with non-grasping, non-clinging. And then when there is that, increasingly, the awareness, it's not mine, it's not me. Once that's clear, okay, then those states are very dynamic. It's dynamic for fear to come, anger. It's dynamic. Powerful expression of life force, and then skillfulness, if that's something that, you know, one is like in therapy situations, people bring very difficult situations sometimes, you know, and the heart is stirred by the violence that humans perpetrate on one another, you know, on children. You know, it's very, very difficult to sit and hear about, you know, rape. And yet, when there isn't identification, if there is identification, there is, okay, and that's okay. And if there isn't identification, then there isn't. And just see it for what it is. And then, generally, back to try to get inside your comment or question, is that that ease of being comes through much more readily, because it's not, it doesn't need to come through. Nobody needs it to come through. So, if you need to try to bring it in, then you need to do that. And then, as that begins to thin out, it tends to come through naturally, and you don't need to do it. I wanted to just share with you. You spoke about your response to my sharing. The heart. Feeling the heart. Ditto. And back at you. I had a client once who was a Hell's Angel. She was a woman. Hell's Angel, decked out, boy, all the way. After we finished up with the therapy, it was a short therapy, right to the point. I thanked her very much for what she shared, you know, in the presence of how she was. And she just looked back at me and she said, "Ditto and back at ya."
It's not like a bad thing. Rebecca. One of the things that Paul was saying that the Dharma, you know, lights people up in different ways. And as you, I'd like for y'all, or invite y'all to look at the picture on the left hand.